This is Cave Scott Allen of OTCode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from LazyCoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This week's episode is being recorded October 14th, 2009. And today we are talking with our good friend Scott Allen, the K. Scott Allen, about victory in software development. And this goes back to something he spoke about at the Fireside Keynote at Concept Camp 2009. So, K. Scott, do you want to tell us what that is, Concept Camp?
Well, first I want to say thanks for having me on the show. Concept Camp was probably the coolest event I've been to in a long time because it was a small event. There was less than 100 people there. In fact, there was less than 20 people there. There was less than 15 people there. I think there was about 12 people there at one time. And it rained all weekend. The weather was miserable. It was cold. But it's really interesting to talk about technical topics and community topics and being rained on. And then instead of like running off and having some sort of box lunch, to actually cook steak over a fire together really brings people together. So it was a lot of fun.
Okay.
That was Sarah Chips that organized that. And she put it together just to have some geeks get together and camp and talk about topics like presentation on giving good technical presentations. We had a presentation on F-sharp from Matthew Podwaisaki, and Sarah Chips gave a presentation. It was a great weekend.
Awesome. So you gave the keynote, which, like, you beat out all other 11 people to give the keynote, which, so first of all, congratulations on that. secondly, your post on this was really cool. You kind of wove in this Civil War story. So do you want to kind of set the stage by telling that?
Sure. Do you want the abridged version?
We got an hour. Go for it.
Yeah, well, I wanted to give most of the people that were coming to this camp were actually not from the area. So I wanted to give everyone a little bit of a flavor of the local history. Because this was being held about 15 miles from my house, and most of the people were coming were from New Jersey or North Carolina. So I told them the story of the Antietam Battle, which was a battle during the Civil War in the United States. It was in 1862. It was after the 11 states in the southern United States decided that they didn't want to be a part of the Union anymore. So they just split off and they formed their own army. And the northern states that we call the Union, they put together an army to try to bring these 11 states back under their control.
Okay, so I've got a question.
Sure.
So when you were telling the story of the Civil War, how many people did not know it at the concept camp?
Well, no one guessed that the battle that I was referring to took place at the Antietam battlefield, which to me is surprising, but I live here, and living here, you get to hear about the Antietam battlefield all the time and how it was still the bloodiest single day in American history because there were around 35,000 casualties just in one day of fighting. I mean, everyone had heard of the Civil War, but people couldn't, you know, drill down into a specific battle.
You'd be surprised sometimes
that question,
how many people don't know about the Civil War and who fought.
Well,
like they have entire episodes of jaywalking devoted to it.
Growing up here, you hear about it all the time. When I went to college, I met some good old Southern boys that grew up in South Carolina and Alabama who really didn't know much of anything about the Civil War. And when they were in school, it was referred to as the act of Northern aggression. So it all depends on your perspective.
Right.
But in any case, the story I wanted to tell was I wanted to talk about how do you define victory. And victory many times really just depends on your perspective and who you are working for or who you're fighting for. In software development, a lot of times I think it really comes down to the customer. It's really up to the person that you're building software for. If they can say that you did a good job, then you can declare victory. Otherwise, it doesn't matter how many unit tests or how far the line went down on the burn down chart and things like that. I don't think you can really declare victory without the opinion of the user. And it really depends, too, on how you spin the story. So if you look at the Battle of Antietam, what had happened is that everyone thought that the Civil War in the United States in the 1860s was going to be over pretty quickly because these 11 southern states were primarily agricultural states. They were really good at growing cotton. They were really good at growing tobacco. You can't use cotton or tobacco to kill people quickly enough to win a battle. Where the northern states, most of the big cities had undergone the Industrial Revolution. So you had New York City and Philadelphia and Baltimore and Boston. Those cities could crank out bullets and uniforms and gunpowder and the things that you needed to kill people. But the war didn't end as quickly as people had thought. There was a general named Robert E. Lee who took command of the Confederate forces, the Southern Army, and they fought off the Union Army when they were just outside of Richmond, which was the capital of the Confederacy. And when they did that, it really changed the war. This was early 1862. So a couple of things you have to realize about that situation is that, first of all, the voters were in the North. That November would be the midterm congressional elections. They weren't going to vote for the presidency. Everyone knows in the United States, anyway, that Abraham Lincoln was the president during the time of the Civil War. But they were going to vote for their congressmen and the senators. And if they were perceiving the war as going badly, it would be very easy for them to vote for people that would just get this war over with so they could get back to a normal life. But even more importantly, you still had a lot of European powers like England and France that were looking at this situation and thinking about providing some support to the South, not just military support in terms of giving them weapons and maybe even soldiers, but just being the first countries to say that, yes, we recognize the Confederacy's claim to being a sovereign nation. They would be the first people to officially do that. And, you know, there was still a lot of colonial thinking at that time. So anything that England or France could do to sort of make the United States a little smaller and split them up would be advantageous to them. So against that backdrop, Robert E. Lee, who had command of the Southern Army, marched it to Northern Territory. It's the first time they had crossed the Potomac. They came into Maryland. The Northern Army started trying to follow them around, and they eventually met in September of 1862 at what we call Antietam Battlefield now. It's just outside a little town called Sharpsburg. It's about 15 miles from my house. And the battle that day was just horrific. And I could go on for hours about the things that happened that day, but you can go to the Antietam Battlefield today and you can walk down a lane that's we now call Bloody Lane. And at the time, it was just known as the Sunken Road because it was just a dirt road over clay soil that the farmers had used to circumvent the small town of Sharpsburg there. And they had drugged their wagons up and down this road and the rain had come down and eroded it away. So it was actually sunken down and it made a perfect defensive placement for the Southern soldiers, the rebel soldiers, to just sit in there and aim their muskets at the Union soldiers that were trying to push them back across the Potomac. And over the span of about 3 hours, there were, I'm trying to remember the number now, but I think it was somewhere around 3,500 casualties just in this 800-yard stretch of road. And they said that their bodies, by the end of the day, bodies were just stacked up there. So it was horrific. Still the single bloodiest day in American history. So at the end of the day, though, to make this story a little bit shorter, Robert E. Lee's army, the Southern Army, had a 30% casualty rate. So 30% of his army was no longer functional. They had to retreat back across the Potomac and go back into the South. The other general, General McClellan, who was leading the Northern Army, considered himself the victor in this battle. He had pushed the rebel army back across the Potomac. He thought he was quite successful. And indeed, just a couple days after that, President Lincoln declared the first Emancipation Proclamation based on what happened at Antietam, which was essentially freeing the slaves that were still in slavery in the South. And that completely changed the face of the war. You have to really try to appreciate what was happening at this point. Up until then, this war was really about tax evasion. The 11 Southern states said, we're not going to be a part of the Union anymore. Someone in the IRS building said, hey, we're not getting the tax forms this spring. What's going on? Oh, no one from these 11 states are filing taxes anymore. Let's put an army together and get those people back under our control. But when Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, suddenly there was a higher cause for everyone to be behind. So the Northern voters who were worried about being in this war, because they really didn't know if they wanted these 11 Southern states to be a part of the United States anymore, said, if we win this war, we can put an end to slavery in North America. And all of a sudden, the European powers that were thinking of providing support to the southern states said, well, I don't know if we should really support a policy that's going to support a slave nation anymore. Mm-hmm. So Lincoln himself won a great victory at that point, because all of a sudden, all the voters were behind the war. The European powers were kind of staying out of the Civil War. And when you tell the story like that, it sounds like a complete victory for the northern armies that came to the Battle of Antietam, because they pushed the South back. They issued the Emancipation Proclamation. Everyone seemed to be quite happy. But, like so many, any story of sufficient complexity, you don't understand the full story until you get to some of the other details. So, for instance, the Northern Army that General McClellan led had roughly almost 100,000 men at the Battle of Antietam. The Southern Army that Robert E. Lee brought into Maryland only had 50,000 men. So they were outnumbered 2-1. General McClellan, who led the Northern Army, essentially fought three separate battles that day. If you read about the Battle of Antietam, there was the battle around the cornfield, there was the battle around Bloody Lane, which was later that day, towards the afternoon, and then in the late afternoon, there was a battle around a place called Burnside's Bridge, where General Burnside decided to march his Union soldiers in columns of two across this bridge to take the position that the Southern soldiers were holding, and because they were lined up so nice and neat coming across the bridge, they were just mowed down for hours as they were trying to get across the bridge. But that, by delaying all of his attacks throughout the day, it allowed General Lee to shift around his forces to meet each attack. And in fact, a couple weeks later, President Lincoln relieved McClellan of duty. Said, you know, what happened at the Battle of Antietam really wasn't acceptable, because most experts then and even now believe that the Civil War could have been over at that point, that the North should have just eliminated the Southern Army, forced them to surrender, and ended the American Civil War. Instead, it went on for three more years, including the Battle of Gettysburg, which was the bloodiest battle of the entire Civil War, but it occurred over a span of 3 days instead of just one day like Antietam. So once you add in those details, you start to think, well, maybe the North really didn't have a complete victory. And the reason I told this whole story is that I think we face a lot of the same situations in software development where it's really hard to define when can you actually declare victory. Is it because you just shipped the product on time? Well, obviously not, because you might have shipped something that the users couldn't actually be functional with.
Right. So then we're really talking about what is victory? Like, how do you define success? Is it a short-term victory? You win the battle for that day, but you've lost the long-term war, or that you could have decisively, like, shipped a game-changing product and you shipped something that was kind of so-so?
Exactly. And I think we're all familiar with the situation in development where you ship something and lots of people talk about technical debt and the short-sighted hacks and all that stuff. Okay, well, you ship something and now they want more features and you can't do anything with it. That's a fairly common scenario in software development, I think. Let's pause for the birds.
Would you consider the birds a victory?
Birds are victory. Birds are win. But I think there's something else that happens in software quite frequently, which is that we've kind of conditioned the users and we've conditioned the people that are asking for features to come to us and ask what's possible. And we have certain constraints in place and we mitigate risk to the point where I think we're missing a lot of the potential that we could deliver in software development. And one of the things that I mentioned in the post was that as engineers and software developers, we're trained to identify risk and try to mitigate it. And if you look at all the things that we do, things like code coverage, unit tests, continuous integration, stand-up meetings, all these things, when we do them well, we feel like we're being successful, we feel like we're being victorious, but all those things that we're doing are really about mitigating risks. So why do we do test-driven development? Because there's a risk that someone's going to write something that's not needed or it's going to be overly complex. So we do test-driven development to try to simplify things. And why do we leave the unit test in place after we do the TDD? Because we're mitigating the risk that we need to go in and change the code and something's going to break. And why do we do continuous integration? Because there's a risk that someone's going to check in code that's going to break the build and it's going to be hard to track down. And why do we do the daily stand-up meetings? Because there's a risk that if you leave a developer alone in a room too long for a week or a month at a time, that they're going to stray from the original intent of what you're trying to get done. And we're trying to mitigate the risk of not communicating and understanding and making sure that everyone's on the same page. So all those things we do are indicators of for success, and they make us feel successful. But what they really are is just mitigating the inherent risk in developing a complex software project and trying to produce something through a complex process.
Some of those things also have a value that does help contribute to a win, so to speak. So the reason that you do continuous integration is not because you're worried that someone's going to break, not just because you're worried that someone's going to break the build, but also so that you can feel confident in deploying a product or giving the product to your end user at any time. So you know that at any given time, you've run your unit test, you've got your CI, you can deploy that product, or you can, you know, demo it to the user at the end of your iteration or at the end of your, you know, whatever unit of time you choose. The other reason that you do the stand-up is that if the requirements aren't clear, you not just that the developers are going to get impeded, but also so that issues with the requirements are brought out quickly, questions that may come up, things like, well, you know, do we really think this through all the way? Or I've got a question about the interaction here. And they're brought up immediately so they can be communicated to the end user, and they can be ironed out before code is written and the thing is set in binary form. And it's the same with kind of the story-based project planning. So the reason that you try to put these things into stories is so that you don't get stuck into the requirements document morass of, you know, earlier software days, where you would try to define out the exact implementation of every requirement and feature and detail it down to each interaction that no one but an engineer can understand. So you come up with story-based project planning so that the end user can be more involved in it and can describe things a little bit better, and also so that you can try to break it down to something that is much easier to do quickly, I think.
I think one thing you pointed out there too is the whole, like, is a big document a win at all? Like, we can delude ourselves that we've been successful by coming up with a document that has the signatures of all these, you know, different departments and everything, but we haven't actually done anything. So how you define victory really kind of has to be tied towards something useful. Like, I guess I'm thinking of this going back to like Vietnam, right? Because there were a lot of reports and statistics that showed we were winning in Vietnam, when really it was just the report showed that what the reports wanted to show.
True.
And the long-term view, as you're pointing out here, you could do the same thing with McClellan's victory at this battle and say, well, you know, big victory. And, you know, it's a short-term thing, but does it actually accomplish your interim goal, or, you know, do much to accomplish your interim goal?
Right. And the point there was that most people look at McClellan and his history and the way he fought that battle and the way he organized things and the way he gave orders and look at him and say that McClellan was just a very pessimistic person who was obsessed with risk. So when he was presented with this battle at Antietam, all he could see was the risk of losing that battle, and perhaps then the Union would disintegrate, everything would be lost. Whereas General Lee, at that point, was only looking at the opportunity. If he could go into Maryland and win a couple battles there, then maybe the war would be over, the North would give up, Europe and France would be behind him. And I think a lot of times in software development, it's really difficult to make a comparison between war and software development. That's something I pointed out the keynote, but one, people get killed in, and the other one's just people in cubicles under fluorescent lights typing in code.
It's a slow death. They're very slowly dying.
Well, so I have a little bit more chipper idea of a quasi win. You know, have you really declared victory? So Gilligan and the crew of the Minnow get stranded on the island, and they never quite get off of the island. But on the other hand, they're stranded there with Ginger and Marianne. So is this a win that they don't, you know, or is this a failure that they never completed their short cruise?
It's a win.
Yeah.
but one of the reasons all this came up is because I had been thinking about a lot of the software I've been working on over the years, because most of my career has been spent on commercial software. I've worked with internet startups where we built great software. We had a great team of engineers. I think it was the best software we've ever written, but that company went out of business. In fact, I've been with a couple companies that are now out of business. But one of the first companies I ever was with, right out of school, I was all by myself there. I wrote software for laboratory devices that are still being used around the world. And I'm trying to figure out which one was victorious. And I have to say that the one where we went out of business, that was a failure. But the worst code that I ever wrote in my life that's still running all over the world, I'd have to say that would be a victory.
You're talking about that code that runs the printer, right?
Yes. One of the things it does is run a little thermal printer. I had a lot of fun with that. Went through a lot of paper.
So I have a story. I don't know if it's time for the stories yet.
It's always time for a story.
I have a story about a big document being a huge, huge win, even though we did develop software along the way. So I worked at this company, and I don't think this is all, I don't know, it's so long ago, and the company's been bought like twice. So I'm not going to use any of the names, but there was this consulting company I worked for, and one of our clients was a large airline. And one of the things that this airline did was so airlines don't really make money off of just the passengers. They also haul cargo they have cargo areas in the planes and in addition to the luggage areas. So they haul like USPS, UPS, FedEx packages and whatnot all around. So they were looking for our company to find instances of waste and how they could increase their profits, of course. So what we did was they went through and they built a computer model of their operation. They went out and they interviewed everyone on the ground. They interviewed the pilots, they interviewed the people who were handling the cargo, they interviewed the post office and all the cargo producers, let's say. And they interviewed the people that took the tickets at the gate, and they modeled out everything. And what they decided was, after they ran the model, they were able to tweak it some. And they looked at it, and they realized that the biggest source of waste was the fact that the cargo was being treated like a person. And by that, I mean that they were trying to find the most expeditious way for this cargo to get to its final destination. So if it had to change planes, they would unload it and then load it again. If it got stuck somewhere, they would unload it and store it. And then the next flight out the next day, they would put it on that flight and it would get to their destination. So they were trying to do it in the least number of hops. And so what we ended up doing was producing a report, a big document that saved them, I don't know, I think the number was around $10 million a year, where it just said, treat the cargo like cargo, essentially. So it doesn't matter how many hops it takes, as long as it gets there by the time that it's supposed to get there. So if it has to go, you know, from LA to Santa Fe to Dallas to Kansas City to Denver to its final destination in Seattle, that's okay. As long as it gets there within, you know, however long it was promised to get there. So if it was FedEx 2-day and it only took a day and a half to get there, that's fine. So there was less handling of it on the ground. There's less, they had to pay less overtime to the crew, the ground crews to unload it and load it. And so that's the story that I used to illustrate, you know, how just because you're a programmer, it doesn't mean that the solution is always software and that you can win and you can solve the user's problem without writing a line of code if you just focus on the problem. And I think that a lot of the reason that a lot of software projects fail is they don't take that into account. They get so involved in the minutia, because that's part of the control that a lot of programmers have to have. So they get involved in what, you know, DI and IOC container should I use, and what kind of validation, and what JavaScript library, and, you know, what kind of library template should I use on this, and there's just so much back and forth, and how can we tweak the UI to be just right, and they forget to solve the problem. In a lot of ways, you know, it's the same kind of CYA behavior, that stands for cover your anterior. that McClellan kind of practiced.
Right. You know,
like, don't commit everybody all at once, even though we could just bulldoze them. Don't try to flank them, because that's risky.
Yep. Like that. That's exactly what I was talking about. And I've been in so many situations where the development team has sort of trained the users and the business people around them to come and ask, well, what's possible, or what are we allowed to do here? Instead of just coming to the development team and saying, here's what we'd like to do. This is what would make our lives so much better. And then the development team trying to figure out a way to do that. And I realize everyone has limited time and resources, but quite often we throw those things back at the users and say, no, we don't have time to do that. Or, no, we don't know how to do desktop applications. Or no, we can't do that because that API is not compatible with our perfect RESTful web service. And so we're using those things as excuses, or we're using those things as ways to get out of the scenario, instead of trying to use them in a formula where we could actually achieve a victory and have the users be happy, productive members of society.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I took away from your post, K-Scott, was that this notion that a lot of times developers focused way too much on the how and not nearly enough on the what. As they get so focused on, you know, the actual mechanics of the construction without spending a huge amount of time on making sure they're really solving the customer's problems.
Right.
And really solving the customer problems doesn't necessarily mean do what the customer says, because the customer doesn't always know what they... customer doesn't always understand how to solve their own problem.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, we're in my company right now, we've got a big push for, you know, this user-centered design process, where it's not, you know, there's this big design process around where you actually watch what the customers are doing and don't have them tell you what they need. You just watch and observe and, you know, sort of draw conclusions based on what they actually do rather than what they tell you that they do. And it's a very illuminating process. A lot of stuff comes out of that you would never think to even tell you. But you can, little things can make a huge difference in their productivity.
Right. I think it was one of Alan Cooper's books where he said, if you actually do everything that the user tells you to do that they want, you'll end up with the dog's breakfast, where the dog's breakfast isn't actually a very appealing thing to build.
Right.
What you have to do is sort of have a better perspective on the scenario and figure out what they're actually trying to achieve, and then mold that a little bit.
And also in with that is the whole idea of, if you ask several people and try and average it out, you usually end up with a total mess, right? Because I would always describe this as, you know, the average of everyone's favorite color is this ugly gray brown, you know, vomit color. Like, and what you're really almost better off, like, I mean, you have to synthesize all that. So you take a lot of inputs, you see what they're asking for, what problem they're trying to solve, and how different people are trying to solve it, and then you come up with the best overall solution. Yeah. This is interesting to me. Lately, my dad had, he wants to start a framing business, photo framing. And so he didn't want to, you know, you're too busy, John, didn't want to bug you. So he went and signed up for a store, and they kind of designed something. And then I've been working with him on trying to kind of get this store system to work the way he wanted to. And it's been really interesting to kind of drop over into that kind of role of, like, looking at, like, I'm not the developer, I'm a customer, or, you know, I'm a client more, you know. And we went through and looked at the store system and, you know, looking at, like, how are we mapping products to the UI and to the store system. And then had someone else look at it, and they said, you know, I don't care about all the products you offer. I'd really prefer to just have a kit. You know, like, I want to frame a picture. Give me a kit with all the stuff. And I don't know. It's really helpful to do that whole thing of, like, stepping back and having several people take a fresh look at it and see what they're trying to do without knowing what the limits are of the store or, you know, the software.
Yep. I was just talking to someone last week for a Silverlight designer who's really good in Blend, which, by the way, if anyone knows a great designer who's good in Blend, you can ping me. But he wanted to bring someone in from the outside because he wanted to develop a great product, and he didn't want he had a couple designers in house, but he didn't want the person to be influenced at all by their current product or their current technical constraints or any of the history of the product that they've been working on for, I think, like 10 years now. So he just wanted someone to come in with a really fresh perspective. He was going to tell them, you know, what kind of user experience. They're trying to deliver what the user's trying to do with this product, and then just have that person design something without any of the current constraints in place. And I told him, you know, that's fantastic what you're doing, because so many places get on a railroad track in one direction, and you just cannot get off of it when you've been working in a place and one product for so long. Don't you think?
Yes. And obviously, as soon as you start going down a path too long, then the ruts develop in the software where everyone just kind of assumes, okay, integration is done in this database. So, you know, or you start getting things kind of baked in that are very difficult to change later.
As an example of that, at my company, we have a couple of these sort of UI interaction models that, you know, date back 15 years that are sort of have been in every version of our product, you know, ways of searching data and stuff. And they seem a little bit funky, and they're not really common, you know, interaction models. But because we've always done it that way, there's always this fear, well, we can't change it because customers are used to having it work that way. And so there's this sort of fear that, you know, if you try to change something, then you screw up old customers, even though you might be, you know, making huge improvements for new customers.
Yeah, fear is a big motivator. That was actually something that I talked about in the keynote, and something I've experienced personally, because I've had people come to me for, I'm thinking of one product in particular that I've spent a lot of time on. It's in the healthcare domain, and it's something that tries to put together information out of a data repository to produce information that a lot of the hospitals in the United States have to produce that measures the quality of that hospital. And some of the information that you have to retrieve is very fuzzy. So yes, you have to retrieve the patient's name. Yes, you have to retrieve some of their diagnosis codes and procedure codes, but all those things are nice and neat and coded, even though they're not, because every data warehouse is like a wasteland of junk data. But there's people at every hospital that have to work on putting some reports together, and they do tremendous number of manual labor hours every month collating information, because some of it comes from Word documents and doctor's notes, and a lot of this information is in the database. And I had someone ask me, well, if we have the doctor's notes typed up in a Word document and they're sitting in this database, why can't you just look at that document and somehow figure out if the patient either was given aspirin or not given aspirin or has an allergy to aspirin? And I said, impossible. Sounds too hard. I'm afraid of that. I don't want to take that risk of trying to figure that out. Not really thinking about the potential savings for an end user. If you think about all the hospitals in the United States and all the people that are trying to figure this out from written notes, you could be talking about thousands of hours a month. All I was thinking about is, you know, things like fuzzy searches and matching and all that stuff is never going to be accurate. I don't see how we could do it. I just, you know, talk the person out of it on the spot without giving an extra thought. And that was basically motivated by fear. Fear of failure, fear of something unfamiliar, fear of not knowing how to do it. Here's what I think is interesting. That book, the Extreme Programming book by Kent Beck, which is the first edition's nearly 10 years old now, he talked about some principal values that you have to embrace in the book. And one of them was simplicity. And I think as software developers, many of us have tried to embrace that value, and we have certain practices and patterns in place to try to achieve simplicity. And we don't always achieve it, but I think at least we work towards that. A lot of places and a lot of developers that I know work towards simplicity for a daily goal. And he also promoted feedback, and we have a lot of ways to get great feedback. So we have things like continuous integration and unit tests and daily stand-up meetings. So we found a lot of great ways to get feedback. But he also talked about courage. And as far as I know, there's no specific pattern, or there's no specific practice. There's nothing that we do on a daily or weekly or monthly or yearly basis that tries to encourage courage in a software developer. So the courage to stand up and say, I think this is wrong. The intellectual courage to try to face a number of your peers and have a different opinion. And just the courage to stand up to a user and say, I don't know how to do what you're asking for. You know, many times if a user asks us to do something, we'll find reasons to tell them why we can't do that because of time or resources, or, oh, we can't use that library. And sometimes we just won't tell them, I don't know how to do that. So part of my blog post was saying that the next time you're faced with that scenario, it's okay to tell someone, to have the courage to say, I don't know how to do that, but if you're willing to give me X amount of time, then maybe I can figure out a way to do that, or at least research it to the point where we can make a more educated decision.
Some of courage has to do with managing risk in the right way, not managing to avoid failure, but like as Scott Kay was saying earlier, you know, like building systems that give us courage, like the whole, you can do a lot on a tightrope wire, you know, when you've got the net underneath. And so, you know, things like optimizing for change. I've found too, you know, in addition to a lot of, you know, software practices, the whole thing of a very frequent release, getting releases out, training everybody, you know, not just developers, but training clients, training everyone around the idea of rapid releases diminishes your risk so much because, you know, you can change things quickly. You can try things. You don't invest in huge architecture or huge features that you're never going to use. Any project I'm on, I'm always pushing subtly for rapid releases and finding some way to sneak them in. Because I do feel like that gives you, you know, like for instance, you know, I don't know if it's a ridiculous fit, but going back to this Antietam, you know, if Lincoln and others were able to see what was going on a minute by minute basis, you know, they'd probably be saying, what are you doing? Get over here. You know, we're not winning in the way we want to win. You know, like there would be, you know, McClellan would be saying, hey, look, we finished sprint one. Look, we're doing awesome. And Lincoln would say, what are you doing? You know,
absolutely. Yeah.
So another thing you mentioned in there, which I thought was interesting, was the idea of a Pyrrhic victory. So what's the idea there?
I almost took that out of the post because I didn't think it was relating to the topic very well, but I'm trying to remember the story. Back in the ancient times, like before there were computers and there was this, I'm trying to remember who was even fighting. It was the Greeks against somebody. But there was a battle fought that the Greeks won, but they had so many casualties and expended so many resources that they knew if they had to fight another battle like that, that it would be over. The entire country would collapse. And so my analogy there was that in software development, if you take the short-sighted hacks just to try to ship something that was due next week, but you're cutting so many corners that you just to be able to ship it next week, but then the following 3 months are spent just rewriting all the crap that you put into the product during that last week, trying to get it out the door, that you really haven't achieved a victory.
I thought Jeffrey Palermo put this in pretty good perspective in his recent post on debunking the duct tape
programmer.
Everyone's
been talking about duct tape for weeks now.
Yeah.
I just can't even stand the look of duct tape now.
I know. Well, the whole idea of, you know, that there are different solutions for different things. So there are occasionally short term or low budget or proof of concept or prototype projects, you know, and so you just have to upfront say the lifespan of this project is this and this is the goal. Because, for instance, I worked on a video player for a sports site earlier this year, and if we were late, the project was a failure. Like there was no, you know what I mean? The one thing that was just required was it had to ship on time and ship early enough that it could be thoroughly tested, you know? And so we definitely made architectural decisions that allowed for, you know, some testing, some, it was a good architecture. We did invest in architecture, but we had to time box it and say, we've got this long, and by this day, architecture will be set and we will move forward because, you know, we have this many months to be done, you know? So I don't know. I'm thinking going back to the whole of like, to define victory, you have to define what is success. And I think that in anything like this whole duct tape argument, you know, there's a whole, you know, people on all sides will make assumptions about what software development is. And in a lot of cases, each project is very different, you know? And so like,
right.
If you're building something that is going to be like a long-term medical software system, well, of course you need to invest in architecture, you know, and you need to continually invest in architecture. And if you're building something that's more short-term or is primarily UI focused, you should focus on something that's, you know, has a solid back end, but is focused on, you know, UI, what's it called? Revving UI, updates, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. So. Yeah. Well, you know, obviously if you have to produce a piece of software that's going to go live for, the next Super Bowl in January, then you have a pretty hard deadline to meet. But chances are you might be able to throw it out after that. But most business software doesn't live in that kind of environment. You have to be able to evolve over time. And I think that's where it's for the user to declare victory for us. And you can't take that measurement at a single point in time. So we can't ship it today and ask the user tomorrow, can we declare victory? You kind of have to ask them tomorrow and the next month and 3 months from now and 6 months from now.
Mm-hmm. All right. Kevin?
One of the points I think of the post was, don't be afraid to tackle really hard problems just because they're hard. That, you know, sometimes in order to really hit the home run, to hit the in order to be victorious, you need to do the hard thing to really make a dramatic impact on a user. And the counterexample I give to that is the whole Vista debacle, you know, where they decided they were going to, you know, change the world and be bold and tackle the really hard problems, you know, that needed to be tackled, you know, the object-oriented file system and the, you know, new UI architecture and whatever that other pillar of Longhorn was. And they totally failed. I mean, they crashed and burned and had to reset the whole project. So I'm curious if you have a perspective on, you know, how do you tackle the really hard problem without, you know, crashing and burning?
Well, I think my point there was that you at least take an honest look at it and not try to say that just up front that, well, this is going to be impossible or this is going to be too much work. I mean, the entire PDC where WinFS and all that stuff was announced was pretty ambitious by Microsoft, and they didn't hit all those points. But I think there's a lot of smaller things that we face every day where, you know, maybe if we extended our business and we hired the right person or we got the right training or we just had the right kind of research done, got some help from outside maybe that we could have tackled this. But we don't do it because we don't feel comfortable bringing someone else in, or we just have a lot of, you know, different excuses to kind of avoid that situation. But I, you know, Microsoft gets a lot of heat for dumping things like WinFS, and certainly it sucked up a lot of resources from what I understand at Microsoft that could have been making Vista better instead of, you know, trying to develop something that didn't work out. But in a way, I sort of admire that they at least went for it, that they tried that. Any company with that much cash in the bank should be able to take risks like that. And if they don't work out, they don't work out.
It kind of seems like, too, there's different ways to, like, take a small gamble and see if it pans out and then double down, you know? Like, I mean, definitely with like, MVC or, you know, just some of these CTP type things, you know, where you kind of get something mm-hmm. out there rather than the kind of like, we're going to have something huge to shock everyone with at PDC or whatever, you know, like, I mean, not just, you know, like as a spectator on Microsoft, I mean, definitely in terms of, you know, projects I work on, I try to, like, if I'm the lead, give people the leeway to, okay, this is what we need to get done this week, and we're going to set aside Thursday for you to, you want to look into, you know, this pattern or, you know, so-and-so, go for it, you know, and you've got, you know, the next two sprints to see if you can get something working. If not, you know, well, you learned something, but we're just not going to be able to pull it off this time around, you know. But so, I mean, making some controlled risks.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And like ASP.NET MVC really wasn't a big risk for Microsoft. It was a small team. There weren't really many people that had heard of this MVC thing when it was coming out. Like if you ask the average enterprise business web developer, I bet they had never heard of MVC until it was released. But it worked out great for Microsoft, I think. So really the risk for them wasn't that MVC wasn't going to fail. I think the risk for them was that MVC might be too successful and completely kill off its web forms cousin.
That'd be a shame.
And then you look at things like Windows Vista. Yeah, not many people liked it. But I must say that Windows 7 with the Windows Live Photo Gallery Editor, let me just show you how that works on my taskbar here at my house party.
Yeah, with that note, I know that a lot of us need to go to get to our Windows 7 house parties, so we should probably wind down pretty soon. I hear the guests at the door now.
John is dressed up as the MSN butterfly, I understand.
Yes, and it was only because my Clippy outfit, the tights, would no longer fit.
Scott Kuhn has his Steve Ballmer suit on.
I was going to say I came as Bob.
And then Kevin, I don't really think people are going to get the Melissa Gates outfit. I mean, bravo for trying, but it's just he's going to hit me. I'm just seeing if you're awake. No,
Melinda Gates. Oh,
Melinda Gates. Yes. Shoot.
Damn it. Nobody ever gets it right.
See, here goes your MVP, John.
Yeah, that's true.
And I'm coming as Paul Allen. I've got like these. I've got like a Portland Trailblazers uniform on or something.
Nice. All right.
I've got a Jimi Hendrix museum. I've got Ticketmaster.
Kevin?
You've got to pay me a $2.50 surcharge just for listening to this podcast.
Convenience fee.
Right.
Yeah. Processing fee.
I just have one follow-up to my previous question. Obviously, Agile is the thing these days. Everybody's doing it. And if you're not, you wish you were. Do you think that there's some problem, some like hit it all to the ballpark problems that are so big and so ambitious that trying to do them inside of a, 30-day sprints, chunked up bits of work just doesn't work? That, if you want to go for the big victory, sometimes, Agile can be more of a barrier than it is an enabler.
My answer would be no. But then I've never worked on something like, I've never worked on a project that tried to, put a man on the moon or launch a rocket to Jupiter or something like that. So
you just launch a rocket every single month and then you just get it better each time.
Right.
You just do a little bit at a time.
Each launch, it gets a little closer to the moon.
Or you run out of astronauts. Well, so if you look back at the history of the space program up to the moon launch, each mission wasn't just, for fun. Each specific mission, and there's a really good a series on the Discovery Channel. I gotta look that up. I think something called the Explorers or something like that. It goes through the initial Gemini program all the way through Hubble. But anyway, they talk about this in detail about how each specific mission taught them something new that they would have to know in order to get to the moon. So like the first time they sent a man up, they were like, can he go up there? can we build a spacecraft that makes it to orbit? And then, there was the going in orbit. Can we make a spacecraft that someone can fly around the Earth? Can they go multiple times? Can they get out and walk around? Can we dock two spacecraft in orbit? And so each mission kind of was agile in a way. It was an iteration. It was, can we do this? And then by the time they got up to, they finally did. They sent, can we, send a ship to a round trip to the moon without landing? And then the one that gets all the press was where they landed finally. That was the next logical iteration.
Mm-hmm. That's a good story. I mean, I personally don't think there's nothing that you can't do with an agile process and a little bit of perseverance. And it really kind of ticks me off when people criticize agile and say that it's not the solution to the problem that we need. It's, I don't know, to me, it's the way life works. I mean, you look at evolution, there's little mutations with every generation that make things a little bit better. And so we're just software developers. I think we should be doing the same thing.
Hmm. All right, there you have it. We've taken you from the Civil War to the Hubble. I think we got to stop there.
Well, thanks again for inviting me to the show.
You're welcome. You know, you've been such a great guest. I think we'll ask you again probably next week.
Oh, yes. That would be awesome.
Well, thank you very much. And join us next week on the Herding Code channel.